Hi, I'm Ivan Semenek. Welcome to The Universe in Mind. This week, hit me with your best shot. You'd think that if our planet were pummeled with dozens of asteroids, each 10 times bigger than the one that wiped out the dinosaurs, it would be game over for life on Earth. In fact, it may have been just the opposite. And the soot of creation, what the darkest, most carbon-rich meteorite ever recovered, is telling us about the origins of life on Earth. So stay with us. It's The Universe in Mind, the show that only brings you stories with high impact.
Planets were born in the swirling currents of the great cloud. Planets near the Sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, evolved as globes of rock. They were too small and their gravitational fields too weak to capture and hold the gases from the nebula.
You're listening to an old NASA animation about the formation of the solar system. It's basically a cartoon, and if you watch it, you come away with a really clear picture of what scientists used to think Earth was like 4 billion years ago, during what's now called the Hadean era. That's Hadean as in Hades, the underworld of Greek mythology. Like the name implies, it's all fire and brimstone, lots of lava, no oceans, and no life. Now, I say that's what scientists used to think, because that's not what they think anymore. We'll get to that in a minute. But the Hadean period also includes something called the Late Heavy Bombardment, a time when asteroids were raining down from on high and liquefying vast swaths of Earth's surface. Strangely enough, it's just after this time in the geologic record that the first evidence for life on Earth appears. It's not fossil evidence, just a ratio of carbon isotopes that looks suspiciously like something was alive and processing that carbon. So now here's the problem. How could Earth go from being sterilized by giant impacts at one time and then settle down quickly enough for life to appear just a geologic blink of an eye later? Oleg Abramov thinks he knows the answer. He's a researcher with the University of Colorado's Department of Geological Sciences, and he argues that if life was around during the Hadean era, it could have survived all those falling space rocks. It may have even been helped along by them. To find out more, I reached Dr. Abramov. Where else? In Boulder. Hello, Dr. Abramov. Welcome to The Universe in Mind.
Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Abramov, I'd like to start with this opening chapter in Earth's history, the Hadean era. Can you paint a picture for me of what, to the best of our knowledge, scientists think the Hadean era was like, and what is it that you were trying to understand about this period of time?
Well, interestingly enough, about 10 years ago, the Hadean era was imagined as a time that was very inhospitable to life. And recent research that came out just in less than years showed that, in fact, that time period had liquid water, temperatures were within an acceptable range for life. It probably had plate tectonics and other processes that we see in the Earth today, so it was not that dissimilar from present-day Earth.
Now, that's really amazing, because we're talking about a period of time that was just, I mean, this is, what, 4.5 billion years ago, just after the Earth formed?
Well, it was 4.4 to about 3.8 billion years ago.
Now, and as you say, originally it was thought that it would not have been a very hospitable place. In fact, the very word Hadean suggests a hellish planet. So is that because of volcanic activity, or what was the original idea why it would have been so inhospitable?
Well, there were several ideas floating around. One is that the impact activity would have made life absolutely impossible on the Hadean Earth.
So lots of asteroids crashing into the surface.
Precisely, yeah. And the other thing is volcanic activity, as you mentioned. It was still unclear how quickly the Earth cooled, how quickly the crust cooled, and the original view of the Hadean Earth was perhaps a partially molten surface, volcanic eruptions going off everywhere pretty much simultaneously. And it was recently shown that the crust of the Earth actually cooled fairly quickly, and plate tectonics probably started fairly quickly after the formation of the Earth. So if you were in the so-called Hadean period right now, say 4.2, 4.3 billion years ago, it probably would not have appeared all that dissimilar to you from present-day Earth.
How do we know that? What is the evidence that suggests there was water and and a cooler surface than originally thought?
Well, the oldest material that we have is 4.38 billion years old. And this material is in the form of these mineral crystals called zircons.
Right.
And they're very hardy little things that can survive just about anything, including the rock being molten around them, perhaps as a result of a volcanic eruption or an impact event, or as a result of a metamorphic process. These tiny little zircons can survive all that, and we can analyze these grains, and they provide us clues as to what the environment was like back then. That is really our only window past the late Hay bombardment on what the environment was like back all the way back then.
So now the zircons are saying that things were a little friendlier than originally thought. So let's get to your paper then, because what you're looking at is exactly how friendly that might have been, and in fact whether or not life could have endured during this time. So what specifically were you looking for?
Well, starting from the beginning, if you look at the moon with binoculars, you will see a lot of very large craters, and most of them formed about 3.9 billion years ago during this period of late heavy bombardment. And we know this from the analysis of samples that were returned from the moon by the Apollo astronauts and by the unmanned Soviet lunar missions. And what was found in those samples is that the age of impact melts, or rocks that were melted by impacts, clustered about 3.9 billion years ago. And that was how the late Hay bombardment hypothesis came to be.
And I guess because Earth and Moon are neighbors, basically, whatever happened to the Moon would have happened to Earth as well 3.9 billion years ago.
That's exactly the idea. We see a lot of heavily created terrains on Mercury and Mars. And it appears that the entire inner solar system was pummeled during this late Hay bombardment period. So Earth was probably not spared this bombardment, although we don't have any direct evidence of the bombardment on the Earth because of plate tectonics and erosional processes that basically appear to have erased that evidence. So we have to rely on what we see on other planets, primarily Mars, Mercury, and of course the heavily cratered surface of the moon.
Right, and does the bombardment that you're speaking of, does it essentially close the Hadean period? Is that how the Hadean period ends?
That is considered to be the end of the Hadean period 3.8 billion years ago or so.
Right, so even though the new view is that the Hadean period was more hospitable than people thought, there was still this incredible barrage of incoming debris for some reason, for whatever reason, at 3.9 billion years ago.
You can say it provided the grand finale to the Hadean period.
Right. So now it seems to me that that would have had a detrimental effect on life on Earth. Even if things had been more hospitable than originally thought, this grand finale may have been really a devastating time for life.
Well, that's exactly what we were interested in examining with this study. There have been several previous studies that showed fairly conclusively that nothing could have survived on the surface of the Earth during that time, because it would have been sterilized repeatedly by very large basin-forming impacts that would have deposited perhaps tens to hundreds of meters of very hot ejecta globally sterilizing the surface. And these, to give you a sense of magnitude of these impacts, the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago was about 10 kilometers in diameter. These impacts were over 100 kilometers in diameter, and there were at least 50 or so of them.
Wow, that's a really terrifying image that you've created with, you know, 50 impacts, each one 10 times the diameter of that dinosaur killer.
At least 10 times.
So you've been looking more closely at this, and what have you found?
Well, we were interested in examining the temperatures in the subsurface, particularly in what's called the geophysical habitable zone, extending about 4 kilometers down from the surface, and seeing if anything could have survived the late heavy bombardment. So in order to do this, we basically recreated the late heavy bombardment on a computer. We came up with a computer simulation that randomly smacks the model surface of the Earth with impacts within specified mass and time constraints, and these constraints came from both the cratering record of the Moon, Mars, and Mercury, as I mentioned before, geochemical analysis of samples that were returned from the Moon, and also dynamical models of the early solar system. And then we assigned a thermal field to each impact crater that was created, and the end result was a three-dimensional thermal model of the entire lithosphere of the Earth. And that allowed us to track temperatures within the crust of the Earth during the late heavy bombardment, and particularly in the habitable zone 4 kilometers below the surface. And by tracking these temperatures, we were able to see that the late heavy bombardment, under any scenario that we investigated, would not have been able to completely sterilize the Earth.
So I find that very counterintuitive, because you've just talked about these incredible impacts. How could it be that life wasn't wiped out? How is it surviving?
Well, it's surviving perhaps in vast hydrothermal systems that were created by the largest of these impacts. By hydrothermal system, I mean something similar to Yellowstone, but significantly larger, and something that lasted for millions of years as a result of these big impacts. And because these impacts were so common during that time period, these types of hydrothermal environments were pretty much ubiquitous. And they essentially could have provided a refuge for life if there was any around at the time, and perhaps even in a sort of an incubator that allowed life to flourish during that time period.
So that's really interesting, because what you're suggesting is that despite the fact that these impacts would have been lethal to some extent, they also created hot springs and created a kind of thermal environment that life could colonize and then could use to survive other impacts that came later.
Yeah, precisely. So these impacts had both positive and negative consequences. They sterilized the surface of the Earth, but at the same time they created vast new habitats for life to colonize.
Now, when you say the habitable zone that you looked at is 4 kilometers thick, are you saying that you're looking at the rock that's 4 kilometers below the surface?
Yeah, we're looking at the entire zone, ranging from the surface to 4 kilometers down, so yeah, essentially rocks.
And so what could be living at 4 kilometers below the surface?
We have drilled down to at least those depths, and it was found that viable bacteria exist down that deep. And, of course, because of the geothermal gradient, the temperatures increase as you go down. So those types of bacteria are called thermophiles, or heat-loving bacteria. They're also very common in hot springs in Yellowstone.
So it seems to me like these thermophiles might have been the best equipped to survive the late heavy bombardment.
Well, actually, interestingly enough, our models show that the thermophiles would not have been the only organism to survive the late Hay bombardment. So-called mesophiles, organisms that live between 20 and 50 degrees Celsius, should have been able to make it as well. However, because the late Hay bombardment provided such great habitats for thermophiles to colonize and flourish and multiply, perhaps that is the reason why thermophiles appear to be the common ancestors of all life on Earth.
So I know that one of the big puzzles in astrobiology is how rapidly it seems life appeared on Earth. Shortly after 3.9 billion years ago, there's evidence for life on Earth, and there's always been this question of how could life have emerged so fast? So are you saying then that actually life could have had much more time to emerge and then squeak through that late heavy bombardment?
That appears to be what the evidence is indicating. However, it's far from certain. Ideally, in an ideal world, we would have access to sedimentary rocks that predate the late Hay bombardment that are older than 3.9 billion years old, and would be able to analyze those rocks and see if there's any evidence of biological activity. But that continues to be an ongoing search.
So, Dr. Abramov, what do you think the implications are for life on Earth, for the story of life on Earth, and for life elsewhere in the universe?
Well, I would phrase it this way, that the results of this study push back the possible beginnings of life as we know it to well before the late Hay bombardment. It essentially opens up the possibility that life got started as far back as 4.4 billion years ago, well into the Hadean period. As far as implications for life in the universe, it suggests that life on other heavily cratered planets, say Mars, for example, could have gotten started very early on as well, and could have made it through the bombardment period just as it has on Earth.
Dr. Abramov, thank you so much for telling us about this. It's a very interesting piece of work.
Thank you very much. It's been very enjoyable.
Oleg Abramov is at the University of Colorado in Boulder. His study on the survivability of the late heavy bombardment appears in the May 21st issue of the journal Nature. Nearly 10 years ago, a huge fireball lit up skies across the Yukon and northern British Columbia. It was a spectacular sight that would signal the arrival of an even more spectacular find for planetary scientists, the Tagish Lake meteorite. Now, in our previous interview, we heard how life could have survived giant impacts during the Hadean era. But it could also be that during this time, meteorites played an important role in bringing in the raw materials for life. If so, the Tagish Lake meteorite has an important story to tell, and one of the researchers teasing out that story is Dr. Chris Hurd. He's an assistant professor at the University of Alberta and curator of its meteorite collection, a collection which includes pieces of the Tagish Lake meteorite. At a recent meeting of the American Geophysical Union, I had a chance to sit down with Chris Hurd and find out just what he's been learning from a few chunks of cosmic soot. Dr. Chris Hurd, welcome to the Universe in Mind.
Thank you very much.
So you have to take us back. It's been almost 10 years now since Tagish Lake, since this incredible meteorite over the Canadian North. Can you just recap the events and why this particular fall from space is so significant to meteorite science?
Well, January 18th of 2000, there was a big fireball that was seen over parts of Alberta and BC and the Northwest Territories in the Yukon, the word went out to people in the area where meteorite fragments were thought to have fallen to keep an eye out for things. And it was a week later that a fellow was driving home along the shore of Tagish Lake that he saw something that looked like wolf droppings, I think is what he said, and went over to investigate and found that these were actually meteorite fragments. And he collected those, so this was 25th and 26th of January of that year, so middle of winter, from the surface of Tagish Lake, which was, of course, frozen at the time.
Right.
He collected them on the advice of scientists that were sort of getting the word out at the time, collected them without touching them with his hands and kept them frozen. And
now, how did he do that?
I think he used either a gloved hand or like a clean grocery bag to collect up the sample.
But keeping them frozen?
Keeping them frozen, he put them in his deep freezer, is my understanding.
Oh, just put them in the freezer.
Yeah, just put them in the freezer, yeah.
So because they fell on the frozen lake, which would normally be a big white surface, like a clean slate surface, that's what allowed these fragments to be seen?
Yeah, I think that's a good, definitely a big factor. And in fact, apparently there was a dusting of snow that helped even to cushion some of these fragments. There were sort of areas where there was, where the wind had blown the surface free of snow and it was just bare ice, and there were sort of splotches of black, you know, on the ice, whereas on the snow he was able to pick up these fragments. They're extremely friable. It's a very friable meteorite. You look at it the wrong way and it falls apart, kind of thing.
So now you've been working on this meteorite. How did it get from this deep freezer in British Columbia to your lab?
Well, initially in 2000, the samples were, half of them remained in the deep freezer, and then half of them were sent off to the NASA Johnson Space Center, where colleagues worked on it and distributed it to other researchers, and sort of did what I would consider in retrospect sort of a preliminary examination. Mm-hmm. What's the classification? What is it? What are the sort of basic characteristics? But of course, those samples still belong to the original finder as the owner. Mm-hmm. And what I did in 2005, 2006 is I led a consortium to actually purchase these samples that were collected pristine, you know, these samples right from the surface of the lake from the owner in association with the Royal Ontario Museum and various federal government departments.
So you say it's very friable, so I'm getting a picture of something that's both black and sooty, and I guess it would easily crumble in your fingers, mm-hmm. probably. So why is this meteorite so important?
Well, it turns out it's a carbonaceous chondrite, and not all of them, most of them are actually carbonaceous. In other words, they contain carbon. But it's the most carbonaceous chondrite. It has up to something like 6% by weight of the sample is carbon.
And that's the most carbon ever found in any meteorite?
In any meteorite, that's right. And approximately half, or just under half, about a third of that is actually organic carbon, so organic compounds. And so it's very rich in this type of material. And what we've been able to demonstrate is that, in particular, compounds that are quite volatile that would otherwise be lost if the sample had been collected, had fallen anywhere warmer, mm-hmm. had been collected and kept at room temperature, those would likely be gone or missing from the sample because of evaporation.
I see. So putting it in the freezer was really key, because you're preserving things that would have been with this meteorite in space and would have quickly escaped after it hit the ground if it hadn't been frozen.
Exactly, yeah.
So what sorts of compounds are we talking about? What have you found in this thing?
Well, leading up to what we're presenting at this meeting, we previously had found things like naphthalene, which used to be used in mothballs.
Right.
I don't think it's used anymore for sort of health reasons. But the reason it was used in mothballs is because it evaporates and kills off the moths.
Right.
But we have also just recently found quite high concentrations of formic acid.
And what's significant about formic acid? Why is that a key molecule?
It's sort of in a series as you go from the simple compound of formic acid to acetic acid, which people recognize as being a major component in vinegar, on up to compounds with more and more carbon atoms and longer chains. But the longer chain versions of those are known as fatty acids, mm-hmm. and they are an important component in cell walls. They're actually what allows life to form cells and sort of do its metabolism inside the cell and keep out what it doesn't want.
So I know it's a bit of a cliche, but we are talking about the building blocks of life here
exactly.
in this meteorite.
Yeah.
And the formic acid is not something that would have stayed with this rock if it had landed somewhere above freezing.
Right, and in fact, you know, probably the most famous carbonaceous chondrite of them all, in terms of you know, the building blocks of life, is the Murchison meteorite, and it fell in Australia, and it has very, very low levels of formic acid, and in that, in even those levels, that actually may be terrestrial contamination.
I see.
So we're really looking at, and it may very well have had formic acid in the first place when it was in space, but it hasn't been preserved.
So you're, in a sense, it's as though this is as close as you could get to actually sampling an asteroid as it was in space and bringing it back to Earth. You know, it's kind of done that job for you, but conveniently stayed frozen so that you could do the analysis.
Exactly, and I think it would take, I think it would take billions of dollars, in fact, to send a spacecraft to an asteroid to bring something back. The added complexity of keeping it below, you know, say, you know, at most the freezing point of water,
right,
would probably add additional costs. So we really are fortunate that,
right,
we've had this meteorite fall, you know, under the circumstances. It's been really phenomenal.
And then $1 billion is probably more than your consortium would have been willing to spend, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So this object is, as you say, it's got so much carbon in it. It's got some of these building blocks of life in it. It's a solid object that formed within our solar system, but these organic compounds that are within it, where do they come from?
Well, what's really interesting is you see links to observations, astronomical observations of interstellar space, to observations of comets. These sort of things are detected remotely by these sorts of methods. We see these same types of molecules. Formic acid is actually fairly common in interstellar space. And what is remarkable is that we actually have preserved it in the meteorite. So we do know that there are processes going on, even at very, very low temperatures, sort of 12 degrees Kelvin out there in interstellar space, that enact to produce these types of molecules. But we also know that there are the sample that we have has gone through a lot more. It's not just a direct sampling of interstellar space, far from it. It, you know, we had the whole formation of the solar system, the formation of a disk of dust and gas around a very active young sun, the heating and melting and cooling and all this kind of things going on in the early solar system that are part of what is affected the pieces that have come together to make, for example, the Tagish Lake meteorite. So somehow these organic molecules have survived that. One of the biggest questions is just what are the relative roles that, say, interstellar synthesis, nebular, that is the disk of dust and gas processes, and parent body, that is, geologic processes going on in the asteroid, have played in the synthesis, preservation, retention of these organic molecules.
Right. And so is the idea that these molecules coming from interstellar space, perhaps more synthesis going on when the solar system is forming, then delivered to Earth? I mean, if it were delivered to an early Earth with water, could this have jump-started life on Earth?
That's what we think. I mean, we really think that these types of meteorites are sort of proxies for what would have fallen to the Earth, you know, in early in its history, and provided the right mix of components. So the question is, how do you actually get, you know, sort of what are the conditions that you need, mm-hmm, to preserve those specific compounds? Like I said, you can have processes that go on, especially, you know, the heating and things that happen even after you've accreted, pulled all these pieces together to make your Tagish Lake asteroid or whatever parent body. The heating in the interior, the movement of liquid water around can act to destroy these things as well. So one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is what are the conditions that are necessary to preserve things? It's even just assuming that they're sort of interstellar to begin with, how do you actually preserve those all the way through? And sort of how common is that?
So we've been talking in a very general way about, you know, this type of meteorite, carbon-rich, and what it might say about life and about Earth. But this is a specific object. It was part of a something that might have been up to 10 tons, I guess, roaring through the atmosphere. Is there anything you've learned about this specific body, you know, where it came from in the asteroid belt? Or, you know, what do we know about the history of this specific object in our solar system before it came to be Tagish Lake?
Well, certainly when the orbital calculations show that it's from the outer asteroid belt, when we look at it in detail, and we look at it like from my background of, sort of mineralogy, petrology, that is, you know, what minerals are present, how are they related, and how does that then reflect the processes that have happened, we know that it's a body that was somewhat affected by hydrothermal alteration, heat and water percolating through it, and overprinting the original components, which would be things like chondrules, which, you know, as a chondrite meteor, it has chondrules that would have formed, you know, at higher temperatures from melting and then cooling.
So chondrules are these little bubble type, little
spheres,
and they're embedded within the larger meteor.
That's right. They're embedded within this very, very fine grained matrix of other clays and other minerals.
So water percolated through this, you're saying?
Yeah, yeah, it almost certainly did, and it had. One of the questions is sort of how hot was the water and how much it has affected. So one of the other things that we've been looking at, in fact, is not just how the minerals record, you know, the conditions under which this aqueous alteration or hydrothermal alteration has taken place, but also how the sort of kerogen-like organic matter, because a certain proportion of the organic matter in these meteorites is actually sort of macromolecular, sort of kerogen-like stuff that's as opposed to the formic acid and other things. You can dissolve out or remove the formic acid or other compounds by actually just putting ultra-pure water through the sample and extracting it that way. This other stuff is resistant to that, and that's what we call it insoluble organic matter.
Right.
And
you're calling it kerogen-like. And what is, just as a reminder, what is kerogen?
Kerogen is something that, when we think of it, and if I say kerogen-like, because, you know, when we think of, say, the oil sands in northern Alberta,
right,
we've got, you know, material that has the result of breakdown of biology, you know,
right,
of organisms. This certainly hasn't happened in this case, but
right,
it's the same sort of thing where you've got various chains that are linking together aromatic rings or multiple rings of carbon atoms in this sort of
Is this the kind of stuff that's crusted onto my barbecue, or?
I guess you could sort of think of it as being related to that. So,
right. Yeah. Okay, so there's some of that as well. So, and would that have been the sign of alteration within the solar system or heating within the solar system?
Well, this is the interesting thing. So, we do actually see differences among different samples within the few samples that we've looked at, the three samples that we looked at so far. Mm-hmm. We see differences in the character of that insoluble organic matter. And it's unlike anything else in any other meteorite, in fact. And so it is actually showing probably some other process that is going on the Tagish Lake parent body that may not be recorded in other meteorites. So it really is unique in that sense.
Well, it sounds like it must have been a very interesting object because, you know, as you say, it had water moving through it. It's got this very rich carbon composition. Are there objects out there that would be like this today, somewhere out in the solar system, that we might someday visit or find or sample?
Presumably. I mean, this, like other carbonaceous chondrites, other chondrite meteorites are, you know, represented in the asteroid belt, sitting in these asteroids as leftovers from the formation of the solar system. So presumably there are other asteroids out there. I mean, presumably there's the Tagish Lake parent body asteroid sitting out there somewhere, and other asteroids as well. What's really interesting is the diversity, of course, that, you know, because you've got a whole bunch of different asteroids that have undergone, that are made up of different things, different amounts of things. Certainly not all of them have carbon like Tagish Lake does, that have undergone different geologic histories. And so we get this big diversity, and that allows us, by studying the meteorites in detail, allows us to probe that diversity.
So it sounds like it's been 10 years since it fell to Earth. It sounds like it's yielding a lot of science still. I mean, what do you anticipate will be the future for these samples?
I agree with you completely. It's been a real boon, and I also, really what we did in 2006 was in a lot of ways to repatriate some of this stuff because it was sent off. There was the opinion expressed in 2000 that Canadian researchers didn't really know what to do with with this material, and I don't think that was completely true then, and it certainly is not true now. I think we've come a long way, in fact, in that time frame, in knowing what to do with and applying our methods to teasing out important information from these things. I think that there's two things specifically to Tagish Lake itself, and to learning more from it. Just this summer, we're embarking on a more detailed analysis of amino acids in the meteorite. These were found by previous researchers in 2000, reported on, I think, in 2001. They only found four. I don't think they actually said which four, but they were very low concentration. But what I think is, what I'm excited about is that because we see diversity in all these other aspects between different samples, we could very well find an amino acid rich, you know, chip of Tagish Lake, right? And it's definitely not homogeneous. It's not the same all throughout. So I'm really looking forward to being able to find, you know, something that has, you know, say 10 different amino acids, and then being able to characterize those, and then again link those to the processes that have taken place in the rock, to see, you know, what's required to preserve these amino acids. In general, I also think that we've learned a whole lot about how we respond to meteorite falls, how we actually even handle samples like this, where the concern is for contamination by terrestrial sources. And so we actually have learned a lot, and I think we have a lot to contribute internationally, in fact, to sample return, you know, conditions, the best methods for being able to receive and process and curate samples that would come back from missions to other asteroids, to comets, to Mars, you know, places especially where we're interested in organics.
Right. And rule number one, if you find a fresh meteorite, put it in the freezer.
Put it in the freezer, yeah.
Well, that's Chris Hurd, right. Thank you so much. It's a great story, and we're looking forward to hearing more about this fabulous meteorite.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this episode of The Universe in Mind. Remember, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes. The Universe in Mind is brought to you by the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Toronto. Kathy Parrott is our online producer. Thanks also to Hugh Zhao and Angela Choi. Our cover art is by Bettina Forget, with graphics by Efahan Elby. I'm Ivan Semenek. Be sure to check in again for more news and conversations about the world of astronomy. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep the universe in mind. Thanks.